Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Trayvon Martin was walking back to his dad. His dad's place with a pack of Skittles and an Arizona iced tea. Then he was dead, shot in the chest by George Zimmerman, a 28-year-old neighborhood watch captain in Sanford, Florida, who had called police to say Trayvon looked real suspicious. Now Trayvon Martin's case is a national cause celeb. People want to know, why did he die? Why wasn't Zimmerman charged? Is it the sad old story of dying for the act of walking while black? This hour On Point, the shooting of Trayvon Martin. A heads up, we will be listening to 911 tapes in this hour from the night of the shooting, February 26th, of Trayvon Martin. They are, some of them, heartrending and graphic. Let's listen. Just to get on the scene there, we'll go to Florida in just a moment, but this is was the evening of February 26th. This is Sanford, Florida, just north of Orlando. The neighborhood watch captain, George Zimmerman, Latino, made this 911 call complaining about the then unidentified black man, young, walking in the rain in his community, who would eventually be identified as 17-year-old Trayvon Martin.
Hey, we've had some break-ins in my neighborhood, and there's a real suspicious guy. It's Retrieve View Circle. The best address I can give you is 111 Retrieve View Circle. This guy looks like he's up to no good, or he's on drugs or something. It's raining, and he's just walking around looking about.
Okay, and this guy, is he white, black, or Hispanic?
He looks black.
Did you see what he was wearing?
Yeah, a dark hoodie, like a gray hoodie, and either jeans or sweatpants and white tennis shoes. He's here now. He was just staring.
Things got bad in a hurry, and fatally bad for Trayvon Martin. The Justice Department has now opened an investigation into this shooting. Reverend Al Sharpton is headed down. There have been protests already. There's really an uproar well beyond Florida at this point. Joining me first today from Miami is Frances Robles, staff writer for the Miami Herald. She's been covering the story very closely and the uproar around it. Frances, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What happened on that night to the extent that we know?
Trayvon goes out to the 7-Eleven to get candy and iced tea. George Zimmerman is doing his nightly patrol, and he calls in and he says he sees someone suspicious. He's walking too slow. He's looking in people's houses. He looks like he's on drugs. And so the next portion of this is where things start to get tricky. George Zimmerman gets out of his truck, allegedly to find an address, to tell the police, oh, this is where I am. Which even the police say, well, that's a little weird because he knows the area very well. He should have known exactly where he was even from before.
Right.
And what he claims is that as he's walking back to his truck, Trayvon jumps him. So, you know, maybe there's some kind of exchange. Who are you? What are you doing here? Why are you following me? And the next thing you know, that leads to an altercation. The initial police report did say that George Zimmerman had a bloody nose and that, as we all know, George Zimmerman was carrying a firearm, a semi-automatic handgun, and in what he says, fear for his life, he shot Trayvon. What's really interesting is last night the Sheriff's Department released some other tapes for incidences that did not have anything to do with Trayvon. And what you see there is a pattern where every time George Zimmerman sees an African-American who he doesn't recognize, I don't think he's calling black, you know, the police every time he sees a black neighbor, but if he sees someone he doesn't recognize, he calls the police.
And of course,
the police. Sure.
I wanted to interject, if I may, Frances. So we'll look at that. George Zimmerman, 28 years old. He'd had his own altercation with police some years earlier. Trayvon Martin, zero record. Here he was out for the candy and the iced tea. I mean, there's reports of him on the phone with a girl that he knew, calling her on his cell phone, saying, somebody's following me. And then, as you say, George Zimmerman, 28 years old, saying he got out of his SUV to look at a street address in this rather small gated community. But then there's this tape. I don't know exactly how that lines up with it. This is during a call with the 911 dispatcher. Well, you can listen.
He's running.
He's running. Which way is he running?
Down towards the other entrance of the neighborhood.
Okay. Which entrance is that he's heading towards?
The back entrance.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
Okay.
All right, sir, what is your name?
George. He ran.
All right, George, what's your last name?
Zimmerman.
Francis Robles with the Miami Herald. How does this line up with the self-defense argument? He's not just checking an address. He's saying he's running, and are you following him, the dispatcher asks. And he says yes, and he says you don't need to do that, but it sounds as though he is, Francis.
That's going to be the killer piece of evidence in a case against George Zimmerman, whether it ends up being civil or being criminal. He's going to say, well, after they told me to stop, I stopped. And then I went back to my car, and this guy jumped me. But that his own words throw him in pursuit of this young man is going to be very, very difficult for him to overcome.
The neighbors got worried in a hurry about what was going on out there. Here's more tape from this series of 9/11 calls. Here's a caller saying that the reports of voices, he's saying, and two men wrestling in the dark, something going on, describing what he could see from his window.
There's flashlights and there's a guy.
Okay.
I don't know if that's a cop. Oh, my God.
Okay, you have several calls, and you just heard, you sure, you did you hear when you heard voices? It was just one person talking, right?
There's two guys. There's two guys in the backyard with flashlights.
Okay.
And there's a black guy down that looks like he's been shot and he's dead.
Well, Trayvon Martin was dead. What exactly happened on the way to that is now the issue. And then we have this piece of tape, Francis, where you can actually hear one of them. Trayvon's mother said is definitely her son, shouting, howling, crying in the background, and then a shot and then silence. What do we know about what happens in this tape, Francis?
What's really troubling about those tapes is that the witnesses who called in all had the distinct feeling, belief, they were convinced that the person who was doing the howling was the person who died, because the howling comes to a very abrupt end with the gunfire. And so when Zimmerman tells police, well, I was calling for help, nobody came to help me, and then I was afraid and I killed this guy. So the police have been saying, well, all the evidence, all the witness statements and all the physical evidence matches Zimmerman's account. And so what the lawyers will tell you is that they feel that all of this is being molded. So you have even witnesses who, sure, theoretically what they said matches what Zimmerman said. Somebody was howling and then it stopped. But that's not what they meant. They meant that the dead guy was calling for help and then he was killed. And there's a real distrust there with the police department, because people feel that all of these witness statements and even the calls into 911 are being manipulated by the police department. And that's why you end up with the Department of Justice and the Florida Department of Law Enforcement announcing late last night that they're going to intervene, because at the end of the day, no one has any faith, no one involved in the case in terms of the family has faith in the investigation that's been done up to date.
We've got to go to that tape, and it is the toughest tape. It is tragic. It's really heartrending. Sensitive listeners, be forewarned. This is a woman in the neighborhood describing, calling in again to police, 911, describing what she could hear as she hid away from the windows here. And you will hear in the background somebody howling. Trayvon Martin's mother says, that is definitely my son crying for help. And then you will hear a shot, and then you will hear silence.
I don't know why I think they're yelling help, but I don't know. Just send someone quick. Say, stop.
Okay. Does he look hurt?
I can't see him. I don't want to go out there. I don't know what's going on. So they're sending.
So you think he's yelling help?
Yes.
All right. What is your number?
There's gunshots.
You just heard gunshots?
Yes.
How many?
This one. Jerry, get down. No, come here.
Is he no longer yelling?
No one, I don't know.
A terrible, terrible night. Francis Robles, charges against George Zimmerman, there have been none, right?
Absolutely. There have been no charges. We wouldn't be here talking right now if he had been arrested. What I think has been interesting about this is that as the weeks have gone by, momentum built. You know, this kid died February 26th, and
yeah.
I think the family and everybody, they sort of gave the police their chance to arrest this guy, and that didn't happen. And when it didn't happen, and not only did it not happen, but the police department came out sounding like they were in defense of the shooter. And then the family started saying, wait a second. And then that's when you started seeing a change in strategy on behalf of the, on the family's part, to get the national attention, to get the big name, the big names like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson involved in this. And frankly, it worked.
Al Sharpton in Florida tonight for a meeting there. What has the reaction in Florida been? What kind of community response have you seen, Francis?
You know, that's what's interesting. I don't think that this issue being driven from the community, because remember that that Trayvon was from Miami. He wasn't from.
He was
Miami.
Visiting his dad at his father's girlfriend's place in this gated community. Yeah,
that's right. So that might have been one of the reasons why there was kind of a delay to build up that activism. I did attend a rally last week that was very well attended. You're not seeing, you know, people aren't pouring into the streets and you know burning down buildings or anything of that nature. You're seeing a very civil, very well managed protest.
But I have seen that protest on TV of the people outside the courthouse there, many of them with Skittles in their hands, saying we want justice here.
Right, absolutely. A lot of those were college students who were coming in from different places. So that's an important point, that this has now become a national issue. This is not really a Stanford, Florida issue. It's not a Miami, Florida issue. It's a national problem, putting national attention to this issue.
Francis Robles, the great reporter for the Miami Herald, is with us for just another couple of minutes here. This is young Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton, saying that race was the reason why George Zimmerman killed her son on NBC's Today Show yesterday.
He was reacting to the color of his skin. He committed no crime. My son wasn't doing anything but walking on the sidewalk. And I just don't understand why this situation got out of control.
And here's Trayvon's father, Tracy Martin, explaining what he wants in this case.
Justice. I want justice to be served. This guy should be locked up.
That's justice to you.
That's justice.
Francis Robles with the Miami Herald. What do we know about this young man before this incident? Was there? There's no criminal record. I'm seeing, you know, his teachers describing him here as sunny disposition, but he was suspended from school in Miami. That's why he was up at his father's by Orlando.
Yeah, the family's not saying much. They're keeping mum on why he had been suspended. We do know that he's attended about three different schools. The school that he's at now is one of the best public high schools in Dade County. So we know that this is a family that was trying. You sense that maybe there's something in the background there that they're not wanting to tell you. But you also sense that these are parents who are doing everything they could to make things better. So, okay, let's put him in this school. This is better. Let's take him to Orlando. This is better. But, Tom, I want to touch on something you said before. But what
yes.
is the mentality that leads to this? And this is where I think the 911 calls are really important. If you listen to George Zimmerman's voice, he sounds frightened. And he sounds frightened why? Because Trayvon has his hands in his waistband, and he has something in his hands. And to me, it's a really chilling moment because, you know, was it the Arizona iced tea in his hand or whether it was the cell phone in his hands? If you were walking, if I was walking, if a white teenager was walking, does that same person look scary to you if he has his hand in his waistband? So I think that he's going to use that fear. I think he's going to use it successfully in his defense to say, well, I thought he was reaching for a weapon, or I thought that he was reaching for my weapon, or et cetera.
But nobody argues that what he has was Skittles and Arizona iced tea and a cell phone. But no one is arguing that what he actually had was a pack of Skittles and a Arizona iced tea and a cell phone. That was it.
Absolutely. That's the point. That's the point that's so frightening about this, is that a kid walking down the street with his hand in his waistband, if you listen to George Zimmerman's voice on the phone, that rattles him. And that's what's so scary about this.
Francis,
the other ones.
Yeah, yeah. I got a last question for you, because you can give us this. The Stand Your Ground law in Florida that may mean that it's difficult, maybe even impossible ultimately, to prosecute George Zimmerman. This is new law from 2005. What is it? What does it say?
The law from 2005 takes away a citizen's obligation to retreat the way that you have the right to defend yourself in your house against an intruder, even if the intruder is unarmed, if you are on the street and if you have a reasonable fear that you can articulate that you are in danger of great bodily harm or death, you no longer have the obligation to run. You can fight back. And that's been very problematic in people, when innocent children get killed in gunfire, in the crossfire of weapons that were not intended for them. Nobody gets charged because the person who ultimately fired the gun can say, well, somebody was shooting me and I was just shooting back and I had a right to defend myself. It's going to make this prosecution very, very difficult. And that's where the Department of Justice, it's interesting that it's the Civil Rights Division that is going to be weighing in on this.
Frances Robles with the Miami Herald, we're very grateful to you for your time today. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
Frances Robles in Miami. One more piece of tape from those 9/11 calls on that night, February 26th. There's a woman calling in saying she could see someone laying, presumably dead at the time, on the ground.
It looked like I thought, oh, are those two men talking to each other, or they looked like they were wrestling each other. And then I heard the man saying, help, help. I mean, I would have helped if I could have. He's walking, the police officer is bringing the person away that shot him.
All right, stay inside your house for the time being. Once the scene calms down a little bit, you may...
Oh, God. I mean, they're looking at the person that's dead. I just can't hold. Oh, God.
The 911 call, one of many, from that night, February 26th. And here yesterday, Florida college students rallying outside the Seminole County Courthouse, calling for justice, demanding that Trayvon Martin's killer, George Zimmerman, be held accountable.
Arrest Zimmerman now. Arrest Zimmerman now. Arrest Zimmerman now. Arrest Zimmerman now. Arrest Zimmerman.
Joining us now from Norfolk, Virginia is Michael Denzel Smith. He's a writer for The Nation. His article, Justice for Trayvon Martin, is available at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Denzel Smith, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Atlanta, Georgia, James McBride is with us, writer, musician, writer in residence at NYU. He's author of The Color of Water and Song Yet Sung. James McBride, welcome back to On Point. It's good to have you with us today. It's a sad reason to be here, but we appreciate your joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Michael Denzel Smith, what do you see in this story?
It becomes more and more clear the more facts that we get that at worst the Sanford Police Department is inept at worst they are callous, at best they are inept. Because we keep getting more and more facts that dispute Zimmerman's claim of self-defense. And it becomes more clear that he essentially hunted Trayvon that night and had it in his head before he had any real solid evidence that Trayvon was suspicious, that he was up to no good or on drugs. That he was indeed up to no good or on drugs. Mm. And that night he had enough. We can see the pattern, the 46 calls over 15 months.
He was a frequent caller to police. When you say you had enough, you mean that? Him calling in about this or that from his neighborhood.
Right. Mm-hmm. He had enough. He had a pattern of calling in and reporting suspicious black men that he saw in his neighborhood. And it seems like this night he snapped. And I can't draw any other conclusion because Trayvon was a young black man. Because there's nothing else to point to him being suspicious. If you make him white, then there seems to be nothing else to make him a suspicious character.
James McBride in Atlanta. I mean, we cannot ultimately be judge and jury here, but the elements of this story are certainly disturbing, and it fits in to a long pattern in this country that has been a lethal pattern for any number of young black men.
Well, I was hoping that I would never have to hear that tape, so I had to gather myself after hearing it. I would say that if this death doesn't cause us to examine the way that we see each other in this country, then this wonderful young man pretty much died for nothing. You know, I was suspended from school, and I attended three different high schools. Mm-hmm. And my mother sent me away to my sister in Kentucky so that I would straighten out. My mother understood, like this young man's mother understood, that, you know, whatever his problems were, and they were very minor, and I'm sure the police were not hesitant about checking into his background. Whatever his problems were, his parents clearly loved him, and he was a nice kid. I don't see him as a black kid. I see him as a kid. And I meet teenagers from all over this country. And I'm pretty convinced that that young black men are not only targeted, they are the victim of our own inability to get along. They are the victim of the sale of fear that goes on in this country. The SUVs, the gigantic prison systems, the security systems, the gated communities, the panic button on your car keys, all of this stuff, much of it, the victim of much of this kind of commerce are young black men. Young black teenagers. And I've been stopped many times as an adult and as a boy. And I often made the wrong choice, and even as an adult, because the injustice of it is so great. And so what we have to do is we have to try to, I think we need to come up with ways to address this problem in ways that are positive, that help parents and communities learn to kind of become more aware of who we are and what we need to do. I come from Red Hook, Brooklyn, which is a place where the New York City stop and frisk policy is in effect, and it affects those young teenagers all the time. And a program that I work with called Red Hook Initiative, which is a community group, they actually allow teenagers to create a play that shows them how to respond and react to all this. Now, this doesn't really help when they get stopped on the way home from school. But what it does do, it galvanizes the parents and makes them pay attention so that when the local police have a meeting, in this case a couple weeks ago, I had a meeting with the local captain. He was shocked to see 30 or 40 parents show up to talk about this stop and frisk policy. You know, we have to start talking to each other in real ways. We cannot erase 400 years of oppression in 10 or 20 years. But what we have to do is we have to start talking to each other about what, you know, what this country has evolved into.
We evolved or not evolved out of. I was reading Jonathan Capehart, a columnist in the Washington Post, James Michael. He was talking about, he wrote about one of the burdens of being a black male, he wrote, is carrying the heavy weight of other people's suspicions. One minute you're going about your life, the next you could be pleading for it if you're lucky. And he said that, you know, when he, in the early 80s, moved to Newark, and his mother taught him, don't run in public. Don't run while carrying anything in your hands. Don't talk back to the police. Michael Denzel Smith, I'm looking here to report from ABC News. That Trayvon Martin was on the phone with a 16-year-old girl that night while this was going on. And he said that some man was watching him, so he put his hoodie on. Then he tried to get away. He said he lost the man. Then she said, I asked Trayvon to run, and he said he was going to walk fast. I told him to run, but he said he was not going to run. Do you understand these messages that have been given to young black men by their families for years about how to try and avoid trouble in this situation, Michael?
Absolutely. I mean, I've had those messages passed down to me from everyone in my family, because there's a real sense and need to protect young black men, because you hear this case and you hear echoes of Emmett Till. You hear echoes of Yusef Hawkins, of Sean Bell, of Amadou Diallo, of Oscar Grant. Young black men, it's a life-threatening occupation to be a young black man in this country. Your life is literally on the line every day. And no matter what you do, it seems, no matter how innocent you may be, lay bare all the facts, it's assumed that you're a threat. And so, yes, you receive these messages from when you're very young, that the world will perceive you as a threat, and you need to operate as if, you know, and make everyone comfortable around you, and go out of your way to do so, because otherwise you can die.
I want to go to our listeners. Wilbert's calling from Allendale, South Carolina. Wilbert, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. You know, I'm 65 years old. And about 25 years ago, somebody burnt a cross in front of a lady house in Augusta, Georgia, the Klansman. And we simply just called the district attorney saying, either you arrest him, or we will. And I guarantee, before we got to pick this guy up to take him down to the sheriff's department, they had this guy in custody. People are going to have to start taking responsibility for their community and take responsibility for themselves.
But Wilbert, that's what George Zimmerman thought he was doing, and you see where that got us. I mean, the police said, "Don't get out of your SUV. Don't chase this guy." He took the law into his own hands, and it ended up with this mess.
I'm talking about what happened. What I'm talking about when the law enforcement breakdown is not enforced, citizens have a right to make those arrests themselves.
We have
that right.
I feel that urge. I feel it strongly. Wilbert, we've got it. Al in Boston, you're on the air, Alan. Al.
Hello, everybody. I don't think it's a question of whether this is a case of walking while black. I think the main question is whether the state and federal governments and our society at large are going to continue to allow this and just wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say, yeah, well, that's the way it is. It seems to me that the Stand Your Ground law there in Florida should not apply to this man, Zimmerman. My understanding of the Stand Your Ground laws is that they were designed, as Francis Robles mentioned, to protect a person's right to protect themselves in their own home. Traditionally, in American law, you cannot use deadly force to protect property, but we made an exception a long time ago to allow you to do that to protect your own home.
I'm not sure about the home business here. I apologize, Al, but I mean, I'm reading here that says it places the threshold for self-defense, not necessarily home, so low that you need a little more than your word to show that your life was in danger. George Zimmerman says that he was acting in self-defense, that he was accosted. And I mean, we'll see how that law plays out, but it is said to be tough in these circumstances. I appreciate your call, Alan. One more. Marianne in Newport, Rhode Island. Marianne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say it's such a tragedy to lose the life of this young man, and my heart goes out to his family. But I think it's time we considered the part played by the vitriol that we hear so popular on radio talk shows such as Rush Limbaugh and that kind, that I think fear is spurred on by this kind of constant hate speech. And I think it's time we can consider that maybe it's time to just stop this.
That would be great, Marianne. I appreciate your call. James McBride, I mean, we like to think as a country that we have moved somewhere. It's hard to attribute this just to contemporary hate speech because there's such a history here. There's such a long legacy here. But there is something shocking about this. In 2012, we've got an African-American president. Not that that changes the world, but we'd like to think that things have moved along somehow, James.
Well, I agree. I think that many people thought that when we had an African-American president, that racism kind of ended 10 minutes later. And, well, this is really there's no real script that we can follow to do the right and proper thing. I happen to think that nothing in this country happens unless white folks says it happens. And so this is probably, I'm sure, that this young man's death is the tip of the iceberg in terms of the whole being suspicious part of young black men's lives. When I first heard about it, I called my son and I gave him his specific rules about what he needs to do to survive, and it's no different than what Michael Denzel Smith was talking about, what he learned when he was a kid. I think part of the problem is that we can no longer afford to start seeing each other as different people. We have to start seeing each other as human beings. Now, that's kind of a generic thing, but you can't legislate kindness. You cannot legislate goodness. It has to come from within, from each of us personally.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the uproar over the shooting of young Trayvon Martin in Florida. The young black man out for a bag of Skittles and an iced tea, shot dead by a Crime Watch volunteer, captain, who goes uncharged. Of course, at this point, there has been no trial. There's been no judge and jury that's looked at all the facts. And so, yes, it is pieces. But there will be no trial unless there are charges. And so that has led to a lot of upset among people who want justice, want a careful accounting of what happened here. The U.S. Justice Department is now stepping into this case. Last Wednesday at the Allen African Methodist Episcopal Church in Sanford, Florida, community members gathered to call for justice in the shooting of Trayvon Martin.
Of Mr. Zimmerman and him may not home arrest, We want him behind bars. We need him arrested because you arrested a lot of black men without probable cause. You need to arrest this man.
Arrest this man. Here's the attorney, Benjamin Crump, speaking on behalf of Trayvon Martin's family. This was a news conference last Friday, saying the same thing.
We want an arrest. How many nights do they have to go to bed knowing that the killer of their son is walking around free?
And here's the same attorney. This is on Current TV's The Young Turks. This is on Tuesday in an interview, saying that if the roles had been reversed in the shooting, the outcome would have been quite different.
Had Trayvon Martin been the trigger man, you hit it right on the nail. He would have been arrested day one, hour one, and wouldn't have been given bail. But yet, this guy who disobeyed the police instructions and then got out with a 9mm gun, and the kid has Skittles and a can of iced tea, and he says self-defense, and the police take his word for it.
There, the attorney for the family of Trayvon Martin, Marcus in Des Moines, Iowa. Thank you for calling, Marcus. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm 25. I'm biracial. My dad is black and my mom's white. And just from day one, my dad always told me that there would be people in my life that would unfairly judge me just because of my appearance, and that, you know, life for me would be an uphill battle because of that. And, you know, I've accepted that and as part of my life. And, you know, but my question is, what is it with the local authorities in this case that, I mean, why is the Justice Department having to step in the first place? Just with all of the facts that have come out about the case, like, why hasn't any charges been filed so far? Well, why is it taking the Justice Department to step in?
Well, I mean, all I can tell you at this point is that the local police department has said that they've done it by the book. They've made their best judgment on it. The background here, there had been break-ins in this gated community, and they said, look, we looked this up and down, and we think we did the right thing. But obviously, I mean, to your questions, the same questions being raised by the Justice Department coming in and the Civil Rights Division, I don't know if we can answer more definitively than that, but they the very fact that they're getting involved says something about their satisfaction with the state of what has happened there. I appreciate your call, Marcus. James McBride, Michael Denzel Smith, stand by for a moment. I want to go to New York City. Nicholas Pert joins us. He's a student at the Borough of Manhattan Community College. He wrote an essay in the New York Times titled, Why is the NYPD After Me? This is a long way from Florida, but he wrote about the kind of scrutiny that young black men can come under without, from his point of view, really any justification, but something he's had to learn to live with. Nicholas Pert, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
When you heard the story out of Florida, how did it line up with your personal experience?
The story in Florida is very appalling. It's very appalling, and it, you know, definitely relates to the psychological adjustment that black men have to make in this country in order, you know, to keep themselves safe in interactions like this. The psychological effects, you know, we feel criminalized not only by police officers but by people in authority. And, you know, even to go back to Trayvon's way of thinking, you know, he said, someone mentioned that, you know, he was on the phone with a young lady,
mm-hmm.
and the young lady told him to run, and he chose not to.
At first, anyway, yeah. He said he didn't want to.
The neighborhood that he was in,
mm-hmm.
that all plays a factor in this whole situation that happened so fast. So, you know, this is a very complex issue.
How many times have you been stopped by police, Mr. Pert?
I've been stopped between 5 and 10 times since I was 16 years old, illegally.
And do you have any criminal record?
No criminal record at all.
Were you doing something that I was, you know...
No, not at all. Just living my life on my way to the store, on my way to a party, just living my life or having a hoodie on.
And why do you think you've been stopped so many times?
I've been stopped so many times. It's 'cause I fit the description, quote-unquote. you know, it also goes back to, you know, the subconscious racism, you know, that's in this country that, you know, people really don't like to, you know, pinpoint, you know, just because somebody is, it's not just black and white, you know, someone who's Latino can be racially profiling, you know, what, you know, valid suspicion is not someone coming out of the store, someone coming out of their building. That's absurd. That's criminalizing people. And, you know, we are, it is causing major psychological effects amongst adolescents in the city alone.
Nicholas Peart, we appreciate your taking a few minutes to be with us today. We're losing your phone line a little bit there, but we wish you good luck, and we appreciate your time with us today. Thank you so much for joining us. Nicholas Peart, a student at Manhattan Community College, who's, as he says, been stopped 5 to 10 times since he was 16 years old, and he's still a young man. Courtney in New London, Connecticut. Courtney, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a 48-year-old black male, born and raised in Alabama until I was 18. And I was always taught to do your best to avoid these situations. And one of the things that we knew to do, be in the house before dark and away from the other side of the track, because the racial segregation lines down south usually were a railroad track, a physical track. Since then, I joined the Navy, and I came to New London, Connecticut. Now, what I found being here as early as 3 years ago, I had someone call and said that was a suspicious guy sitting in the parking lot of a Dunkin' Donuts across the street from Sheffield Pharmaceutical Building.
Mm-hmm.
The cops came, locked me in, asked for my ID, and subsequently found that there was no reason to stop me at all. I get a call from the police chief and other people, and the president of the company apologized. Now, this is a systemic problem. It's a national problem. And this is something that goes to the core of what the America continues to be after all the years of desegregation, slavery, and things of that nature. I mean, any time, like if you look at my particular situation, I just retired from the Department of Corrections for the state of Connecticut. Back in 1999, I was let go from the Department of Correction for a violation of my teaching certificate. However, I had 10 of my colleagues who were Caucasian who also had violations but weren't let go.
So,
I take this situation to the court, and the judge summarily dismissed my right to a jury trial.
So you're a long way from the South, from Alabama where you grew up, or from Florida for that matter, but we hear your instance there of sitting while black in Connecticut. And, and we've got it, Courtney, and I appreciate that call very much. One more right here from Des Moines. Dave, you're on the air, Dave.
Hi, Tom. I was a member, or I participated in a thing called Gang Peace Initiative in Boston. I think it was 88 with Shakira Lee, and it was in response to a killing that happened in Mission Hill. A guy shot his wife and his unborn child, a white guy, and he said it was a black guy that did it. He was a real scum. But what happened is just all hell broke loose in Boston. My roommate was a black man, and I had to schedule our lives together so every time he left the house, he'd leave with me, because if he did not leave with me, he would be slammed down on the street and beaten by the police. They were just beating every black man that they could find. And when I took part of
beating, not just questioning, you really mean beating?
And I didn't understand that as a white man, Tom, until I took part in this. And I had these, and they were essentially just young men in Roxbury. Some of them were gangbangers. They might not have been the best, some of them were, but they said, "You guys, you have no idea what our life is like. I walk out the door and I am hunted." And it's very hard for a white person to understand that. So when you even hear a black man say that, most white people say, "Oh, they're just, you know, being a little paranoid. This is just," but this is the fear that they live in every day. They walk into a situation and they have to put you at ease. Imagine that.
Imagine every time you went somewhere in public, you would have to put the people around you at ease. You could not just live your life, because if you didn't, you would draw this rage and this ire. And it was an eye-opening experience to me. I could barely understand it from my perspective. And, you know,
Dave, we've got it, Dave. That was a famous case and a rough time. And yeah, there were a lot of rough accostings. Certainly accostings or questionings that went on there. I appreciate your call. I mean, James McBride, what do we do with this? The first thing that people in Florida want is they want a judicial inquiry, not to judge it automatically, but I guess they would like, you know, a trial or an arrest.
Well, they should get the arrest and more. And the police who cooperated with trying to cover this up should be fired or jailed, as far as I'm concerned. I should also say that, and the last caller was profoundly correct in terms of his summation of what it is to be a black man walking around. Black teenagers, any white teenagers, don't know how to function, don't know how to, you know, process a lot of this stuff. But I think it's important that we can't lay all of the blame of this on the police. The blame that's involved should be centered right on each and every one of us. We have to reexamine our sense of values and our priorities and our sense of self in terms of who we think we are as a nation. That's really where the core of this is. I mean, functionally, sure, all of this is coming too much after the fact. We have to do what that last listener did. We have to reexamine how we see each other and what we want the society to be. And that means examining who your cops are, who's the chief of police, who are you voting for, what do you do in your own community to push the good forward, to inch it forward just a little bit. That's really crucial.
And, of course, this was not even a policeman, Michael Denzel Smith, in this gated community. This was a volunteer, kind of self-appointed crime watch guy. But if you...
I'm sorry to cut you off. That's true. But the police response to it was one that we are very familiar with.
But he was in a community. You heard in the tape when he calls 911, he says, we've had break-ins here. And the record is there. There were break-ins in this community. He was...
So mm-hmm. what? So people mm-hmm. lost their, you know, somebody lost their stereo. Big deal. I mean, we're talking about property crimes. Nobody was getting killed there. Nobody, you know, no one was kicking in the doors and raping women. Someone lost their car, car got stolen, someone broke in their house. Okay, big deal. It doesn't mean that this kid has to lose his life based on someone. What is your property worth?
Well, I hope not.
I mean, not your property.
I hope not his life. I hope not his life. Gene in Greenbrier, Tennessee. Gene, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hey, listen, I've really enjoyed the show, and the gentleman, Michael.
Michael Denzel Smith with us here, yes.
Yes, I found a great deal of honesty in what he was saying that maybe some of the rest of us need to look at maybe. I think we're all guilty of racism and bias. I think we've all got a certain degree of bias that we have. And when we come to the plate and we want to discuss these things with each other, I think we all need to admit that we have sins of commission and omission, and that, hey, we've all said the N-word, you know, at some time or other people have done that too towards us of color. And so I would just like to see folks deal with their own bias and racism and political problems and step up and discuss this thing after we look at ourselves. Thanks, Tom.
I appreciate your call, Gene. Michael Denzel Smith, James McBride says, yes, the same. Look into yourself. Let's look into ourselves. Look into our communities here and who the leaders are who have influence over this. There will be a Justice Department investigation. What do you hope comes out of this, Michael?
Yeah, I appreciate the last caller because it's very easy to go about your life and say that you're not a racist. But to live in America is to be affected and to have internalized racism. So we all have to come to the table and say, you know, not that I'm not a racist, but in fact, I am a racist. Being a racist is not the worst thing that you can be. You know, the worst thing that can happen because of your racism is a boy that, like Trayvon, can die. So you have to address your own biases and racism that we've all internalized. I mean, I hear those screams from the 911 call, and I know that it haunts me. But there's a 13-year-old witness who says, you know, he hears those screams, And he knows that he fits the stereotype of the type of people that get killed. So what type of effect does that have on him? We are all internalizing this every single day. And we all have to work on that.
Amen to that. James McBride, there's a special pain in having this conversation even now in 2012. I mean, we have a national history. We share it. We know it. And it has, yes, it has profound racism in it. But you hope and pray that we're moving somewhere.
Well, we are. I mean, it's difficult. And again, as I said earlier, if this young man's death doesn't cause us to examine the way we see each other and examine our own internal racism mechanisms, then his death was for nothing. So I hope that your last caller and Michael's words are prophetic and helpful to the listeners. It is painful, and this is the painful unraveling of racism is really what's happening here. And so I hope we all carry it with us, and it helps us to make a better nation.
It's a sad story in the case of Trayvon Martin. We do not know the whole story yet, but what we know is troubling. I appreciate very much the two of you being with us to think about it today. James McBride, author of The Color of Water and Song Yet Sung, joining us from Atlanta. Thank you very much for being with us, James.
Thank you.
Michael Denzel Smith, writer for The Nation. His piece, Justice for Trayvon Martin, you can get to through our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Denzel Smith, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.